Good morning. Sure good to be with all of you this morning. Bring greetings from all the brethren in Puerto Rico, and especially my wife and my daughter. We were trying so hard to get them up here at some point. I had a trip planned for 2020 that we had to cancel because of the pandemic up here, and we've been trying ever since to get sort of a family vacation to New England going and get everybody up here to this congregation, and it just hasn't worked out. But they send their love, especially Anna, who has been here before and knows some of you. We really hope to get all of them up here so that we can all be together. Been enjoying spending time with several of you, specifically with the Biesekers and the Bishops and the Buntings. And I'm taking volunteers of a family that starts with B for the time today. So we'll see how that works out. Open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 27. And we're going to read four different passages from four different Gospels to start off. We're going to be talking about the third most well-known Joseph in the Bible today. This is not Joseph, the son of Jacob in the Old Testament. This is not Joseph, the father of Jesus. This is Joseph of Arimathea. And this Joseph in particular is interesting because he's actually mentioned in more of the Gospels than Jesus' own father. And he's mentioned more times in the New Testament than the Old Testament Joseph. And that's pretty impressive. And it's even more impressive when you realize how few things actually end up in all four Gospels. If you look for the different stories that end up in all four of the Gospels, there's only just a few of them. And yet Joseph of Arimathea shows up in all four. And so what he did was significant. What he did was something that all four of the gospel writers believed that their audiences needed to know, and of course that the Spirit knew that we were going to need to know about. And so we want to talk a little bit about him this morning. The accounts are fairly similar, but they're different enough that we can pick up different details in each one. And so we'll read each one in succession, be prepared to flip to the next gospel very quickly, and we'll talk a little bit after each reading about what it says to us about Joseph. Matthew chapter 27, starting in verse 57. It says, "Now when it was evening, a rich man from Arimathea came, named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him, and Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut out of the rock. And he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the tomb." And so in this passage, we'll just focus on the fact that Joseph is a rich man. And he's so wealthy that he can afford a new tomb, a tomb that is carved out of the rock. And that's pretty impressive. This is something that only the very wealthy would have had. You would have to be almost nobility. We'll find out a little bit later that he's basically that to have. And so you think about all the labor that it would take to carve a tomb out of rock. And even if sort of there was a pre-existing cave, you've got people without modern machinery going in and just hacking away at this solid rock to build this thing out for Joseph. And it's supposed to be his tomb. It's supposed to be a tomb for his family for generations to come. And he has paid for this. And he is now willing to give this tomb to Jesus as sort of a parting gift after Jesus has died. We also learn in this passage that it is Joseph that has the stone rolled over the entrance. And so Joseph is concerned about the security of the tomb. He's concerned that Jesus' body be protected in the tomb. And of course, that's going to come into great importance a little bit later on when the body is suddenly disappeared. And how is that to be explained? Is it resurrection? Or is it, as the Jews said, that the body was stolen away and that kind of thing? And that stone plays a really important part in all of that. Look at Mark chapter 15 now in verse 42. Mark chapter 15 and verse 42. We have Joseph of Arimathea, who is a rich man. He has a new tomb that has been hewn out of the rock. And Mark chapter 15 and verse 42 says, "When evening had already come, since it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council, who was himself also waiting for the kingdom of God, and he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Now Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And after learning this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. Joseph bought a linen cloth, took him down, wrapped him in the linen cloth, and laid him in a tomb which had been cut out in the rock. And he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, were watching to see where he was laid. And so here we learn that Joseph of Arimathea is not only a member of the council, that's the Sanhedrin, that's the governing body of the Jewish people, but he's a prominent member of the council. And we don't know exactly what that means other than just to suggest that when Joseph spoke, the entire council listened. Later on, we're going to see something very similar with Gamaliel in the book of Acts. Gamaliel speaks up and one person sort of changes the mind of the entire council. And Joseph seems to be that kind of guy. He has the respect of the entire council. He has the respect of all of the Jewish people. If there's anybody besides somebody like Jesus who had sort of come on the scene and become famous throughout all of Israel, Joseph is going to be that kind of person that all of Israel knows, and that especially the leaders of the people, the priests, and especially the council members respect. And yet, as prominent as he was and as important as he was, as he goes to Pilate to ask for Jesus' body, he has to gather up courage. And we'll talk about the second half of why that is when we get to the next reading. But we do need to understand that Joseph is somewhat intimidated by Pontius Pilate. When you look back at what Pilate did to the Jewish people, I mean, some of the things he did were just awful. Jesus even has people coming to him asking about the time when Pilate mingled the blood of certain people with their sacrifices. And so, you know, the idea is that Pilate has no respect whatsoever for the Jewish people, and it seems that the only reason he grants them what they want with regard to Jesus' crucifixion is perhaps he had gotten himself in enough trouble and there was enough tumult building up among the Jewish people that he kind of had to give them something, sort of throw them a bone in order to satisfy them. That seems to be the best explanation of that, just historically speaking. But Pilate and the Jewish people had a very contentious relationship, and it was not a guarantee that Pilate was going to give any of them what they wanted. As a matter of fact, even when he granted them the crucifixion, he puts a sign over Jesus's head on the cross that says, "This is the King of the Jews." And it's just sort of a fist shaking at the Jewish people saying, "I'll give you your crucifixion, but I'm not going to let you get off the hook. I'm going to tell everybody that it's your king on the cross." And so, is he going to get the body? He has no idea. Is he going to be counted as a disciple of Jesus? Is he going to get arrested? Is he going to get crucified? What's going to happen to him? He has to gather up courage to go before Pontius Pilate to ask for the body of Jesus. And that is no small thing, as we will see. We also find out from Mark that it is Joseph who buys the linen cloth that Jesus is wrapped in. And that's going to come back into our lesson a little bit later this morning as well. Nicodemus is responsible for a lot of the spices. The women are also responsible for some of them, apparently. But that cloth that wraps Jesus' body, the grave clothes, that was Joseph that brought that. And so he not only gives Jesus a tomb, but he also gives him the grave clothes that he is wrapped in. Luke chapter 23 now. Luke chapter 23, verses 50 through 55. It says, "And a man named Joseph, who was a member of the council, a good and righteous man, he had not consented to their plan and action," that is the plan and action of the council, "a man from Arimathea, city of the Jews, who was waiting for the kingdom of God, this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus, and he took it down and wrapped it in a linen cloth and laid him in a tomb cut into the rock where no one had ever lain. It was preparation day, and a Sabbath was about to begin. Now the women who had come with him from Galilee followed, and they saw the tomb and how his body was laid." And so here we find out that not only is he rich, not only is he a prominent member of the council, not only does he do something rather kind for Jesus after Jesus dies, but we find out that he is a good and righteous man. And as we'll talk about in just a minute, that sort of stands in tension with his fear. And so we wonder, you know, what kind of a person this is. If he's afraid, if he has to gather up courage to go before Pilate, is he a good and righteous man? And Luke assures us that he is. And not only that, we find out that he doesn't, as a member of the council, consent to what the rest of the council wants. He doesn't push for the death of Jesus the way the rest of the council did. And we don't know how he refused to consent to that. We don't know if he just didn't show up for the meeting because he knew what was going to happen, or if he did show up, that he remained quiet, or maybe he spoke out in the middle of the council. It's hard to tell with exact precision how he would have refused to consent to their plan in action. But we do know that he did not participate actively in pursuing Jesus' crucifixion. He stands against the council either silently or publicly, and we can't really be sure which, except to say that it was because of his righteousness that he did not do that. And that's a very big thing. Also, we learn about the tomb in this passage, that it was a tomb in which no one had ever lain. And so we also know that it's a completely empty tomb, which is a really important detail when it comes to Jesus' resurrection. It's not some other body that gets mixed up with Jesus' body that disappears. It's not a different set of bones that just disappears from the tomb. There's no one else in there except for Jesus' body. And so only one of two things could have happened. Either his body gets stolen away or he's resurrected from the dead. And if the stealing of the body doesn't add up, then it's resurrection. And the proof of that is going to be important a little bit later in our lesson as well. Finally, let's look at John chapter 19. John chapter 19 and verse 38. John chapter 19, starting verse 38. Now, after these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, requested of Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate granted permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 liters worth. So he took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden there was a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. Therefore, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So a couple of things about this passage. First of all, we find out that Joseph is a secret disciple of Jesus. And he's kept that a secret because he's afraid in this passage of the Jews. It's not just Pontius Pilate that he's afraid of. He's afraid of the Jewish council as well. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the fact that he really didn't have much reason to fear the people exactly. A lot of the people were either neutral to Jesus or they were actually on Jesus' side. They kind of liked Jesus. But he was afraid of his own council members, and so that's what keeps him from coming out and publicly confessing his discipleship in Jesus. We also find out that one of the reasons Jesus gets laid in Joseph's tomb is because it was nearby. And that tells us a couple of things. First of all, it tells us that Joseph's tomb is in a really important location. Jesus dies right outside the city of Jerusalem. And that area right outside the city of Jerusalem, if you've got a tomb carved out of rock in that place, you've got the richest of the rich tombs. I mean, this is, you know, this just magnifies the wealth that we know that Joseph possessed and his importance. But it's also important because everyone knew where Jesus was crucified. Everyone knew where the garden was. Everyone knew where the tomb was. The council knew, Pilate knew, the disciples knew, the people just wandering around Jerusalem knew. This was not a secret place. They put him there for convenience, of course, but it was an honorable burial, and it was also a very public thing. Even if there weren't just big crowds surrounding, everyone would have known where Joseph's tomb was. So let's talk about Joseph just a little bit. First thing we want to say about Joseph is that one thing that's interesting about him is that his faith fully came to life after Jesus died. His faith comes to life after Jesus is dead. For Joseph, the cross, as it so often did, forced him to actually take a stand one way or the other about Jesus. Once the cross happens, Joseph realizes that he now no longer has a choice. He has to either step up and publicly confess his discipleship, or he can just slink off into the shadows and disappear, but he can't stay secret anymore. He can't stay neutral anymore. He has to make a decision. John 19 tells us that Joseph had been a secret disciple of Jesus. And in the scriptures, in general, secret discipleship is really never looked on very favorably. When we look at the heroes of faith, we do see a few of them who kept certain things secret early on, but the reason that they're heroes of faith is not because of the secret discipleship or keeping their faith to themselves. It's because they learn how to step up and actually take a stand for things. And so you think about Abraham. Why do we remember him? Because he's so afraid that he's going to get killed that he refuses to tell people who Sarah really is. Well, that's not why we remember him. It's certainly a stumbling block on his way to better things, I suppose, but that's not why we remember him. In that moment, it's actually contrasted with why we remember him, because there God has promised him his protection, and Abraham does not believe God. And he does things to protect himself that ends up putting his wife in danger, that ends up putting the very promises of God in danger had God not controlled the situation the way that he did. Now, we remember Abraham for his fearlessness when he takes his son up on Mount Moriah and he's ready to sacrifice him, believing with all of his heart that there's nothing that he can do and that there is nothing that this world can do to stop his son from being the child of promise, even if he's dead. That's why we remember Abraham. Why do we remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Well, it's because they were willing to go to their deaths rather than bow down before Nebuchadnezzar's image. Why do we remember Daniel? Because even over something as simple as what food to eat, he's willing to stick his neck out and face death for that. Why do we remember Esther? Same reason. She's willing to go to her death to do what is right. We remember these people for their fearlessness, and then we look at Joseph of Arimathea, and he's a secret disciple because he's scared. That's not a very good sign. Even though Luke comes in and says that he is a good and righteous man, he is a good and righteous man, but he's conflicted and he's got a decision that he really needs to make. Joseph spends most of 3 years apparently secretly following Jesus because he fears the Jews. And that means that he fears his own colleagues. As we mentioned earlier, he doesn't really have to fear the regular people that much. The regular people kind of like Jesus. They're the people that are getting healed by him. They're the people who have family members or friends who are healed by him. It may even be for them that Jesus was nothing more than entertainment, and he did really cool tricks. You know, who knows why they liked him, but they really didn't have that much of a problem with him. Not very many people among the common folks wanted Jesus dead. John chapter 7 is kind of an interesting passage because Jesus does some amazing things there, and the people are talking among themselves about Jesus, and they say, "Isn't this the one that the Jews want to kill?" And it's like, "Well, you're Jews, you know." It's like, "Well, they're not the ones that they're talking about. They're talking about their leaders. We're talking about Joseph's people, the council members. They're the ones that want Jesus dead." And so Joseph doesn't speak up. He's afraid to speak out because every single one of his council members, except for one who's Nicodemus, and we don't know whether they knew about each other before Jesus died, he believes that all of them hate Jesus, and he's afraid to speak out. So why didn't he make his faith public? I'm sure that he had several excuses that might have been offered for that, and we don't know which one of these, if any of them, is right, but we can kind of imagine why he might have kept that a secret and justified it to himself. It could be that he didn't think the council was ever going to get around to actually killing Jesus. And that wouldn't have been a bad guess at a certain point during Jesus' ministry. There were times in Jesus' ministry where the council was just about ready to kill him, and then they looked at the size of the crowds following Jesus, and they said, maybe not. And so Joseph has every reason to believe that they've threatened to do this before and they didn't follow through. What makes anybody think they're going to do it this time? And so he didn't say anything. And so he gets lulled into a sense of complacency for that reason. It could be that he sort of rationalized his own decision. You know, what could one man's voice do against 68 or 69 other voices on this council? And that's just an excuse if that's what he was thinking to himself, because there are times where one voice can change that many people. You know, in the book of Acts, again, Gamaliel's voice changed the mind of the entire council. Joseph was in a position to do that, but we've all been in positions where we were the only one. And it wasn't even a number that big. We were the only one among 10 people or 15 people. And so we just kind of curled up and didn't say anything because that's what everybody else was doing. And it would have been so easy for Joseph to do exactly that. And maybe that's the reason that he didn't express his faith publicly. Maybe he thought that he might be an inside source for Jesus. He could really be valuable by not saying anything. I can sit on the council and I can pass messages to Jesus' disciples about what's going on in the council and everything. And maybe I can be a secret informant or something like that. Who knows why he didn't come out? These are all potential reasons. We don't know which ones he would have picked. But Joseph's got his reasons for keeping secret. And none of them are good. None of them really satisfy. And what the cross does is it brings Joseph to a position where he has to make a decision. He can't remain secret any longer. In Luke chapter 23, verses 50 and 51, it tells us that Joseph was a good and righteous man. And the moment where he realizes, I think, that he cannot stay secret any longer is when the council actually begins seriously plotting how they're going to crucify Jesus and how they're going to go before Pilate and get him executed. And as this plan starts to take shape, this one's different from all the other plans. This is a calculated plan. This is something that they've spent all night formulating. It's not the sudden, you know, rush of the moment like all of their other anger against Jesus had been. And Joseph realizes that this is different. And so, one way or the other, he refuses to take part in that council. Does he not show up for the meeting? Does he just remain quiet during the meeting and never give his vote? Or does he stand up and say something? We don't know which one of those things he did, but he could not remain quiet any longer. And not only is that the case, but as he goes to Pilate for Jesus' body, he's making a statement to everyone, including Pontius Pilate. Crucifixion victims were not buried. Apart from Jesus, and really, since we don't have the body of Jesus, obviously, we don't even have it with him, but we know that Jesus was buried. There's only one other crucifixion victim, to my knowledge, that we know was actually buried in a grave, in a tomb. And there's this guy, I forget what his name is. We actually know his name because it was carved on a bone box. And you open up the bone box and you find this ankle bone and it's got a nail through it. And so everybody knows how this guy died. And that's the only crucifixion victim, apart from Jesus, that we know was actually buried in a tomb. Everybody else is put into mass graves or they're left up on the cross to be eaten by birds and stuff like that till their corpses fell down. You know, they didn't get buried. That was part of the thing. You didn't crucify somebody and then give them an honorable burial. The crucifixion was dishonor, and you follow that up with more dishonor, and that's the way it worked. And so when Joseph goes to Pilate and asks for Jesus' body, he is breaking Roman protocol. And he is certainly going against the wishes of the council. And the moment he makes that request, that is the last moment Joseph will ever spend on that council. He's gone after that. And it may be the last time that he could live in Israel without being someone marked by the council. Joseph knows that he's laying everything out on the line because of this. The cross demanded that Joseph make a decision. If he didn't stand for Jesus then, and he never would. We find ourselves in those situations sometimes. We have to take up our cross and follow Jesus. Jesus did not say, "Watch me take up my cross and observe me from a distance." He didn't say, "Watch the apostles take up their crosses and watch all of us and just kind of observe how we do it." He tells every one of us to take up our crosses and follow him. And there are going to be situations where what we believe will go against popular opinion, whether that's just true in society in general or whether it's true within the group that we are a part of. It's going to go against the popular opinion. It's going to go against what everyone else is doing. And the temptation is going to be just keep my head down and don't look like anybody. Because that's easy. And the fact of the matter is, very often, that does succeed in avoiding us the very problems that we are afraid of. Sometimes it works. And so we keep our head down and we don't lose whatever it is that we are afraid of losing. The friendship, the relationship with a family member or something like that. Maybe it's something on the job. We don't lose the promotion. We don't lose the pay raise. We don't lose the relationship with the boss. You know, who knows what it might be, but we don't lose that, at least for the time being. And then things go back to normal, and we get to just sort of plod along like normal, like nothing ever happened. But the cross has a way, and sort of on the other side of things, Satan has a way of forcing our hand. Because what the cross demands is our total allegiance, and what Satan wants is to pull us away from the cross, and so we're going to have to give our allegiance to one or the other. And the longer we go on trying to keep our head down, the more likely it's going to be that things are going to build up and build up and build up to the point where we realize we should have taken a stand a long time ago. I think we're seeing this culturally. People don't say things in the early stages of corruption. And so you look at things like, you know, just the little issue of, you know, tolerating certain behaviors, tolerating certain lifestyles, and then it comes into, you know, we're going to change the bathrooms around, or we're going to change this around or that around. And the next thing you know, it's like, well, we can do that out there, but not in here. We're not going to change what we say in here. We're not going to change what we do in here. But you better believe that the same people that want us to do things differently out there want to change in here too. And so are we going to take a stand or are we not? And the cross will force our hand. We'll find ourselves in a position at some point where we have to take a stand and say, I either believe in the cross or I deny it completely and I reject it and it means nothing to me anymore. And the earlier we start taking that stand, the better. And Joseph found that out the hard way. One more thing about Joseph's decision. His faith in Jesus' death is kind of fascinating here. The best evidence of a false Messiah is a dead Messiah, isn't it? That's how they figured out all the rest of them were fake. Jesus wasn't the only one that claimed to be the Messiah. And so there were some that came before him, and they led little revolutions against the Roman government and that kind of thing. And a lot of them ended up on crosses, actually. And as their bodies are laying there rotting on the cross, everybody kind of figured out, well, that's not a real Messiah. And so they just walked away and looked for the next guy. And so this should have been Joseph's sign. This wasn't the real Messiah. And so what is it that actually leads Joseph to express more faith in Jesus after Jesus' death than before? You know, you look at the disciples after Jesus has been crucified. You look in Luke chapter 24, and as Jesus meets the guys on the road to Emmaus, they tell him, well, you know, we had hoped that he would be the Savior of Israel. We don't have that hope anymore. He's dead. Of course he's not the Savior of Israel, but we had hoped that he would be. And of course, by the end of it, they find out that Jesus has been resurrected and the hope isn't dead. But for them even, Jesus' death meant we just misplaced our faith. And yet for Joseph, it did not mean that. And you've got to ask yourself, well, why is that? How is it that he can express more faith after Jesus died than he did while Jesus was alive and doing all those miracles? And I think the answer in Joseph's case has to be that he had observed Jesus. He had observed the miracles. He had observed the teaching. He had observed his lifestyle, and he saw a truly blameless man that they brutally killed in an unjust fashion. But Jesus isn't the only one that Joseph has been watching. He's also been watching his own council members. And he has watched as these people behaved in an incredibly wicked way. They have lied about Jesus. They have deceived people about Jesus. They were stubborn in their hearts, and they refused to believe even that Jesus was innocent. Not even, you know, not placing faith in him for other reasons, but they wouldn't even believe in the blamelessness of Jesus and the fact that he did not deserve crucifixion. And so they crucify an innocent man. And the decision that Joseph really had was, is he going to put more faith in a dead righteous man or more faith in living wicked people? And he chose the dead righteous man. And it's pretty clear that he's not necessarily hoping for resurrection. You don't put somebody in a tomb if you're hoping he's going to rise again before the very final day. And you don't wrap him up in a burial shroud and pack it with spices if you're not anticipating that the body will rot. And so he's not looking at this as honoring the guy who really is going to be the Savior of Israel or anything like that. He just knows that he wants to be on the side of righteousness, and he's willing to put his life on the line for it, even if it means putting his faith in a dead man. And that's a pretty tremendous amount of faith. And it was faith that was brought out because the cross forced his decision. But let's look a little bit at Joseph's gifts to Jesus. He gives him two things. He gives him the tomb, and he gives him the burial shroud. When you think about it, those are about the two most worthless gifts you can give to the resurrection and the life. The creator of life, the one who can destroy the temple of his body and raise it up in 3 days, does not need a tomb, and he does not need a burial shroud. As a matter of fact, those are about the last things he needs. His body is not going to undergo decay. Have you ever given something to somebody and you just realized, maybe even as you were giving it, that it was about the most worthless thing you could possibly give them? We went to Italy a few years ago, and we took with us several paintings that we had bought from a street painter in San Juan, and they were good paintings. We really liked them and decorated our house with them and that kind of thing. And we took them to Italy with us to give out as gifts to people who, you know, we had stayed with and who did things with us and stuff like that. And so we take these over there, and it turns out one of the things we ended up doing was we went down to Florence and we went to the Uffizi Museum. And just priceless collection of art. And the reason we went there was because my wife's father is colleagues with a fellow who's a history professor in the university in Florence. And this guy's wife happens to be one of the directors, I'm not actually sure what her position was, but of the Uffizi Museum, such that she could come out and meet us and take us around the lines and straight into the museum. We didn't have to wait the 3 hours that everybody else did, and that was kind of cool. And so we show up to meet her and exchange pleasantries and everything, and we pull this painting out, and right as we're about to give it to her, we realize that we are giving this woman who works with Rembrandts and Caravaggios a street painting from Puerto Rico. It's just like, that was the wrong thing, you know? And she takes it and she goes, "Thank you so much. This will look great in my daughter's bedroom." She's like, "Well, yeah, she's not going to even put it there, is she?" You know? And I wonder if Joseph looks back on this a little bit later and thinks, you know, I gave God a tomb and I gave God burial clothes, and that might have been the wrong thing. And the fact of the matter was that it was the wrong thing to give the Messiah, to give the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, to give the resurrection and the life. But Jesus accepted them. And not only did he accept them, Jesus used them. And he used them in some of the most powerful ways that we can imagine. Look back with me at Isaiah chapter 53. In Isaiah chapter 53, of course, we have a very vivid description of Jesus' death. And interestingly enough, although I don't know that Joseph was really thinking about it at the time, Joseph himself makes an appearance in Isaiah 53. In verse 7 it says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due? His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit found in his mouth. Now, I want us to think about a couple of things about this passage. First of all, as I mentioned, I don't think Joseph is thinking about this passage as he's putting Jesus in the tomb. This is just a move of convenience on his part. They needed somewhere to put the body, and that was the nearest place. But imagine Joseph reading back through Isaiah after this and realizing that hundreds of years before he ever put Jesus in that tomb, Isaiah had talked about him. It was Joseph of Arimathea, the rich man who put Jesus into the tomb. And not only that, but look at why he was placed in that tomb. He was placed with a rich man in his death because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. He's in Joseph's tomb as vindication. Everyone is looking at Jesus as the crucifixion victim, the one who could not bring himself down from the cross, as a person who is worthy of dishonor, as a person who's worthy of all the mockeries that they threw at him. And what does Joseph do? He places him in a place of honor to vindicate him. And so, just doing that by itself, if that was all that had happened, was incredibly important. But it's even more important than that. In Acts chapter 2, in verse 27, Peter's preaching on Pentecost. And this is only days after Jesus' resurrection, only days after Jesus has been put in the tomb and then, of course, on the third day, risen again. Acts chapter 2 and verse 27, quoting the psalm, it says, "Because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence." Peter says, "Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to be with, sworn to him with an oath, to seat one of his descendants on his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up again, to whom we are all witnesses." And so Peter stands before the very people who crucified Jesus, the very people who put guards at that tomb of Joseph to make sure that nothing happened to the body. And he stands up and he says, "David said somebody wasn't going to decay in death." And we know who it wasn't, because David's tomb is with us to this day. There's a tomb we can go visit. We can roll that stone away. We can go in there and we can find David's box and we can look in it and there are his bones. He said, "There's another tomb in town. And when you go to that tomb and you roll that stone away and you walk inside and you look at the slab, there's no bone box. There are no bones to put in it. There never were. They walked right out of there with Jesus himself. That tomb is empty. And the Holy One of God did not suffer decay." Joseph's tomb becomes one of the most convincing reasons that 3,000 people obey the gospel on Pentecost and that millions of people have obeyed the gospel since. We're about to come up on Easter, and so there's going to be all this advertising for Easter services all over. And you're going to see these billboards. And what's the picture on every single one of the billboards? It's some rendition of the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. It is the symbol of resurrection and life. And so Joseph, very temporarily, looks back on it and sort of facepalms himself, you know, and says, "Why did I give the resurrection and the life a tomb and a burial shroud?" And the answer is because God can take the most feeble of gifts and transform them into things that are useful for the salvation of the entire world. When we look at our lives, we have very little that we can offer Jesus. The most talented among us, if we're really honest with ourselves, understand how little we have to offer. One thing that is constantly brought home to me, I tend to preach and teach in my second language, and when you do that, it doesn't matter how long you've spoken it or how well you know it, you're just constantly realizing that you're speaking with one hand tied behind your back. You just don't have the full set of tools, if you learned it as an adult anyway. And I remember the first Sunday that I was in San Juan and tried to preach for the first time down there, and I got in the car after we were done, and I said, what are we doing here? You know, did I make the wrong decision? Because it didn't go as well as I had envisioned it in my mind. And that scene, to a lesser extent, has played out over the years since. And every now and then, I'll just, you know, make a mistake and just wonder, well, what am I doing here? And what I have to remind myself of is the story of a guy on the south side of the island that I met. And I was introduced to him because, and I hadn't met him before, this was sort of early on in my time down there, but there was another brother from the States that had come down to spend a week with them and to do some teaching and that kind of thing. And this brother that had come down, he didn't speak much Spanish at all. And come to find out that this family he was going to spend a week with didn't speak much English at all. And so I was translating between them, and so the brother from the States looked at him and said, looked at me and said, can you tell him that I'm sorry that I'm not going to be able to communicate with you better? And his response to me was, well, we learned the gospel from somebody that didn't speak Spanish. He said, we sat down with him every day with dictionaries, and we just spent hours looking at this, and he said, he taught us the gospel. And all of a sudden, I look at, what I can do, which is a little better than that. And I think, well, maybe that's a gift God can use. And in Joseph's case, not only did he have a rather feeble gift, but it was a gift given after 2 years, 3 years of very mediocre faith. He's a good and righteous man, but he keeps his faith a secret, and he comes to find out in one sudden moment that he made the wrong decision. And so he gives these gifts up, in reality, kind of as, not necessarily an afterthought, but just the best he could do at the moment. And you go away from things like that thinking, well, how can this possibly be useful? How is my gift useful, and how has my life been useful? And you start to feel like a failure until you realize what God can do with stuff like that. He doesn't need you to be Jesus himself in the flesh. He needs you to be somebody who desperately wants to be like him and who tries and often fails and picks yourself up and tries again. He can use that. And he used it with Joseph, and he will use it with us. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the gospel in some way, you may be feeling like you haven't been very useful to the Lord. You've been putting off repentance. You've been putting off publicly standing for the Lord. You've been putting off confession. You've been putting off making things right with people that you need to get forgiveness from. Or maybe you're not a Christian and you've been putting off being baptized in the Lord and beginning your life with Christ, and you look back on your previous life and you see a life full of mistakes and failures, and you wonder if you really should bother, if Christ can use you. And Joseph's answer is, absolutely he can, and he will. Simply obey him. So if you need to respond this morning, please do so as we stand and sing.